felt him was sweeter than a kiss. Loras Tyrell had been the last to face her wrath that day. He had never courted her, had hardly looked at her at all, but he bore 3 golden roses on his shield that day, and Brian hated roses. The sight of them had given her a furious strength. She went to sleep, dreaming of the fight they'd had, and of Sir Jaime fastening a rainbow cloak about her shoulders. It was still raining the next morning. As they broke their fast, Nimble Dick suggested that they wait for it to stop. "When will that be? On the morrow? In a fortnight? When summer comes again? No, we have cloaks and leagues to ride." It rained all that day. The narrow track they followed soon turned to mud beneath them. What trees they saw were naked, and the steady rain had turned their fallen leaves into a sodden brown mat. Despite its squirrel skin lining, Dick's cloak soaked through, and she could see him shivering. Brian felt a moment's pity for the man. He has not eaten well, that's plain. She wondered if there truly was a smuggler's cove or a ruined castle called the Whispers. Hungry men do desperate things. This all might be some ploy to cozen her. Suspicion soured her stomach. For a time it seemed as though the steady wash of rain was the only sound in the world. Nimble Dick ploughed on, heedless. She watched closely, noting how he bent his back, as if huddling low in the saddle would keep him dry. This time there was no village close at hand when darkness came upon them, nor were there any trees to give them shelter. They were forced to camp amongst some rocks, 50 yards above the tide line. The rocks, at least, would keep the wind off. "Best we keep a watch tonight, m'lady," Crab told her, as she was struggling to get a driftwood fire lit. "A place like this, there might be squishers." Squishers? Brain gave him a suspicious look. "Monsters," Nimble Dick said with relish. "They look like men till you get close, but their heads is too big, and they got scales where a proper man's got hair. Fish belly white they are, with webs between their fingers. They're always damp and fishy smelling, but behind these blubbery lips, they got rows of green teeth sharp as needles. Some say the first men killed them all, but don't you believe it. They come by night and steal bad little children, padding along on them webbed feet with a little squish-squish sound. The girls they keep to breed with, but the boys they eat, tearing at them with those sharp green teeth." He grinned at Podrick. "They'd eat you, boy. They'd eat you raw." "If they try, I'll kill them." Podrick touched his sword. "You try that, you just try. Squishers don't die easy." He winked at Brian. "You a bad little girl, m'lady?" "No, just a fool." The wood was too damp to light, no matter how many sparks Brian struck off her flint and steel. The kindling sent up some smoke, but that was all. Disgusted, she settled back down with her back to a rock, pulled her cloak over herself, and resigned herself to a cold, wet night. Dreaming of a hot meal, she gnawed on a strip of hard salt beef, whilst Nimble Dick talked about the time Sir Clarence Crabbe had fought the Squisher King. "He tells a lively tale," she had to admit, "but Mark Mullendore was amusing too with his little monkey." It was too wet to see the sun go down, too grey to see the moon come up. The night was black and starless. Crabbe ran out of tales and went to sleep. Podrick was soon snoring too. Brain sat with her back to the rock, listening to the waves. "Are you near the sea, Sansa?" she wondered. "Are you waiting at the Whispers for a ship that will never come? Who do you have with you?" "Passage for 3, he said. "Has the imp joined you and Sir Dontos, or did you find your little sister?" The day had been a long one, and Brain was tired. Even sitting up against the rock with rain pattering softly all around her, she found her eyelids growing heavy. Twice she dozed. The second time she woke all at once, heart pounding, convinced that someone was looming over her. Her limbs were stiff, and her cloak had gotten tangled round her ankles. She kicked free of it and stood. Nimble Dick was curled against a rock, half buried in wet, heavy sand, asleep. A dream. It was a dream. Perhaps she had made a mistake in abandoning Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer. They had seemed like honest men. "Would that Jaime had come with me," she thought. But he was a knight of the king's guard. His rightful place was with his king. Besides, it was Renly that she wanted. I swore I would protect him, and I failed. Then I swore I would avenge him, and I failed at that as well. I ran off with Lady Catelyn instead and failed her too. The wind had shifted, and the rain was running down her face. The next day, the road dwindled to a pebbled thread and finally to a mere suggestion. Near midday, it came to an abrupt end at the foot of a wind-carved cliff. Above, a small castle stood frowning over the waves, its three crooked towers outlined against a leaden sky.
"Is that the Whispers?" Podrick asked.
"That look a bloody ruin to you," Crab spat. "That's the dire den where old Lord Brune keeps his seat. Road ends here, though. It's the pines for us from here on."
Brian studied the cliff.
"How do we get up there?"
"Easy." Nimble Dick turned his horse. "Stay close to Dick. The squishers are apt to take the laggards."
The way up proved to be a steep stony path hidden within a cleft in the rock. Most of it was natural, but here and there steps had been carved to ease the climb. Sheer walls of rock, eaten away by centuries of wind and spray, hemmed them in to either side. In some places they had assumed fantastic shapes. Nimble Dick pointed out a few as they climbed.
"There's an ogre's head, see?" he said,
and Brian smiled when she saw it.
"And that there's a stone dragon. T'other wing fell off when my father was a boy. Above it, that's the dugs drooping down like some hag's teats." He glanced back at her own chest.
"Sir, my lady," said Podrick, "there's a rider."
"Where?" None of the rocks suggested a rider to her.
"On the road. Not a rock rider, a real rider, following us. Down there," he pointed.
Brain twisted in her saddle. They had climbed high enough to see for leagues along the shore. The horse was coming up the same road they had taken, 2 or 3 miles behind them.
"Again?"
She glanced at Nimble Dick suspiciously.
"Don't squint at me," Crab said. "He's naught to do with old Nimble Dick, whoever he is. Some man of Brune, most like, come back from the wars, or one of them singers wandering from place to place."
He turned his head and spat.
"He's no squisher, that's bloody certain. Their sort don't ride horses."
"No,"
said Brian. On that, at least, they could agree. The last 100 feet of the climb proved the steepest and most treacherous. Loose pebbles rolled beneath their horses' hooves and went rattling down the stony path behind them. When they emerged from the cleft in the rock, they found themselves under the castle walls. On a parapet above, a face peered down at them, then vanished. Brain thought it might have been a woman and said as much to Nimble Dick. He agreed. "Brune's too old to go climbing wall walks, and his sons and grandsons went off to the wars. No one left in there but wenches and a snot-nosed babe or three."
It was on her lips to ask her guide which king Lord Brune had espoused, but it made no matter any longer. Brune's sons were gone. Some might not be coming back. "We will have no hospitality here tonight. A castle full of old men, women, and children was not like to open its doors to armed strangers."
"You speak of Lord Brune as if you know him," she said to Nimble Dick.
"Might be I did once."
She glanced at the breast of his doublet. Loose threads and a ragged patch of darker fabric showed where some badge had been torn away. Her guide was a deserter, she did not doubt. Could the rider behind them be one of his brothers in arms?
"We should ride on," he urged, "before Brune starts to wonder why we're here beneath his walls. Even a wench can wind a bloody crossbow."
Dick gestured toward the limestone hills that rose beyond the castle with their wooded slopes.
"No more roads from here on, only streams and game trails. But my lady need not fear. Nimble Dick knows these parts."
That was what Brian was afraid of. The wind was gusting along the top of the cliff, but all she could smell was trap. What about that rider? Unless his horse could walk on waves, he would soon be coming up the cliff.
What about him? If he's some fool from Maidenpool, he might not even find the bloody path. And if he does, we'll lose him in the woods. He won't have no road to follow there.
Only our tracks. Brain wondered if it wouldn't be better to meet the rider here, with her blade in hand.
I'll look an utter fool if it's a wandering singer or one of Lord Brune's sons. Crab had the right of it, she supposed. If he is still behind us on the morrow, I can deal with him then.
As you will, she said, turning her mare toward the trees.
Lord Brune's castle dwindled at their backs, and soon was lost to sight. Sentinels and soldier pines rose all around them, towering green-clad spears thrusting toward the sky. The forest floor was a bed of fallen needles as thick as a castle wall littered with pine cones. The hooves of their horses seemed to make no sound. It rained a bit, stopped for a time, then started once again, but amongst the pines they scarce felt a drop. The going was much slower in the woods. Brian prodded her mare through the green gloom, weaving in and out amongst the trees. It would be very easy to get lost here, she realized. Every way she looked appeared the same. The very air seemed grey and green and still. Pine boughs scratched against her arms and scraped noisily against her newly painted shield. The eerie stillness grated on her more with every passing hour. It bothered Nimble Dick as well. Late that day, as dusk was coming on, he tried to sing. A bear there was, a bear, all black and brown and covered with hair, he sang, his voice as scratchy as a pair of woolen breeches. The pines drank his song as they drank the wind and rain. After a little while, he stopped.
It's bad here, Podrick said. This is a bad place.
Brain felt the same, but it would not serve to admit it. A pine wood is a gloomy place, but in the end it's just a wood. There's naught here that we need fear.
And what about the squishers and the heads?
There's a clever lad, said Nimble Dick, laughing. Brain gave him a look of annoyance.
There are no squishers, she told Podrick, and no heads.
The hills went up, the hills went down. Brain found herself praying that Nimble Dick was honest and knew where he was taking them. By herself, she was not even certain she could have found the sea again. Day or night, the sky was solid grey and overcast, with neither sun nor stars to help her find her way. They made camp early that night, after they came down a hill, and found themselves on the edge of a glistening green bog. In the grey-green light, the ground ahead looked solid enough, but when they'd ridden out, it had swallowed their horses up to their withers. They had to turn and fight their way back onto more solid footing.
It's no matter, Crab assured them. We'll go back up the hill and come down another way.
The next day was the same. They rode through pines and bogs under dark skies and intermittent rain, past sinkholes and caves and the ruins of ancient strongholds whose stones were blanketed in moss. Every heap of stones had a story, and Nimble Dick told them all. To hear him tell it, the men of Crackclaw Point had watered their pine trees with blood. Brain's patience soon began to fray.
How much longer? She demanded finally. We must have seen every tree in Crackclaw Point by now.
Not hardly, said Crab.
We're close now. See, the woods is thinning out.
We're near the narrow sea.
This fool he promised me is like to be my own reflection in a pond, Brain thought, but it seemed pointless to turn back when she had come so far. She was weary, though. She could not deny that. Her thighs were hard as iron from the saddle, and of late she had been sleeping only 4 hours a night whilst Podrick watched over her. If Nimble Dick meant to try and murder them, she was convinced, it would happen here on ground that he knew well. He could be taking them to some robber's den where he had kin as treacherous as he was, or perhaps he was just leading them in circles, waiting for that rider to catch up. They had not seen any sign of the man since leaving Lord Brune's castle, but that did not mean he had given up the hunt. It may be that I will need to kill him, she told herself one night as she paced about the camp. The notion made her queasy. Her old master-at-arms had always questioned whether she was hard enough for battle. You have a man's strength in your arms, Sir Goodwin had said to her more than once, but your heart is as soft as any maid's. It is one thing to train in the yard with a blunted sword in hand, and another to drive a foot of sharpened steel into a man's gut and see the light go out of his eyes. To toughen her, Sir Goodwin used to send her to her father's butcher to slaughter lambs and suckling pigs. The piglets squealed, and the lambs screamed like frightened children.
By the time the butchering was done, Brainn had been blind with tears, her clothes so bloody that she had given them to her maid to burn. But Sir Goodwin still had doubts. A piglet is a piglet. It is different with a man. When I was a squire young as you, I had a friend who was strong and quick and agile, a champion in the yard. We all knew that one day he would be a splendid knight. Then war came to the Stepstones. I saw my friend drive his foeman to his knees and knock the axe from his hand, but when he might have finished, he held back for half a heartbeat. In battle, half a heartbeat is a lifetime. The man slipped out his dirk and found a chink in my friend's armour. His strength, his speed, his valour, all his hard-won skill. It was worth less than a mummer's fart, because he flinched from killing. Remember that, girl?
I will, she promised his shade, there in the piney wood. She sat down on a rock, took out her sword, and began to hone its edge.
I will remember and pray I will not flinch. The next day dawned bleak and cold and overcast. They never saw the sun come up, but when the blackness turned to grey, Brainn knew it was time to saddle up again. With Nimble Dick leading the way, they rode back into the pines. Brainn followed close behind him, with Podrick bringing up the rear upon his roundsey. The castle came upon them without warning. One moment they were in the depths of the forest with nothing but pines to see for leagues and leagues. Then they rode around a boulder, and a gap appeared ahead. A mile farther on, the forest ended abruptly. Beyond was sky and sea, and an ancient tumble-down castle abandoned and overgrown on the edge of a cliff.
"The whispers," said Nimble Dick. "Have a listen. You can hear the heads."
Podrick's mouth gaped open.
"I hear them."
Brainn heard them too, a faint soft murmuring that seemed to be coming from the ground as much as from the castle. The sound grew louder as she neared the cliffs. It was the sea, she realized suddenly. The waves had eaten holes in the cliffs below and were rumbling through caves and tunnels beneath the earth.
"There are no heads," she said. "It's the waves you hear whispering." "Waves don't whisper. It's heads."
The castle was built of old unmortared stones, no two the same. Moss grew thick in the clefts between the rocks, and trees were growing up from the foundations. Most old castles had a godswood. By the look of it, the whispers had little else. Brainn walked her mare to the cliff's edge, where the curtain wall had collapsed. Mounds of poisonous red ivy grew over the heap of broken stones. She tied the horse to a tree and edged as close to the precipice as she dared. 50 feet below, the waves were swirling in and over the remnants of a shattered tower. Behind it, she glimpsed the mouth of a large cavern.
"That's the old beacon tower," said Nimble Dick, as he came up behind her. "It fell when I was half as old as Pod's here. Used to be steps down to the cove, but when the cliff collapsed, they went too. The smugglers stopped landing here after that. Time was they could row their boats into the cave, but no more. See?"
He put one hand on her back and pointed with the other.
Brainn's flesh prickled. "One shove and I'll be down there with the tower."
She stepped back. "Keep your hands off me." Crab made a face.
"I was only. I don't care what you were. Only."
"Where's the gate?"
"Around t'other side."
He hesitated. "This fool of yours, he's not a man to hold a grudge, is he?" he said nervously. "I mean, last night I got to thinking that he might be angry at old Nimble Dick on account of that map I sold him, and how I left out that the smugglers don't land here no more. With the gold that you've got coming, you can give him back whatever he paid you for your help." Brainn could not imagine Dontus Hollard posing a threat. "That is, if he's even here." They made a circuit of the walls. The castle had been triangular with square towers at each corner. Its gates were badly rotted. When Brainn tugged at one, the wood cracked and peeled away in long, wet splinters, and half the gate came down on her. She could see more green gloom inside. The forest had breached the walls and swallowed keep and bailey, but there was a portcullis behind the gate, its teeth sunk deep into the soft, muddy ground. The iron was red with rust, but it held when Brainn rattled it. "No one's used this gate for a long time."
"I could climb over," offered Podrick, "by the cliff.
Where the wall fell down?
It's too dangerous. Those stones look loose to me, and that red ivy's poisonous. There has to be a postern gate. They found it on the north side of the castle, half hidden behind a huge blackberry bramble. The berries had all been picked, and half the bush had been hacked down to cut a path to the door. The sight of the broken branches filled Brian with disquiet. Someone's been through here, and recently.
You're fooling those girls, said Crab.
I told you.
Sansa?
Brian could not believe it. Even a wine-soaked sot like Dontus Hollard would have better sense than to bring her to this bleak place. Something about the ruins filled her with unease. She would not find the Stark girl here. But she had to have a look. Someone was here, she thought, someone who needed to stay hidden.
I'm going in, she said.
Crab, you'll come with me. Podrick, I want you to watch the horses.
I want to come too. I'm a squire. I can fight.
That's why I want you to stay here. There may be outlaws in these woods. We dare not leave the horses unprotected.
Podrick scuffed at a rock with his boot.
As you say. She shouldered through the blackberries and pulled at a rusted iron ring. The postern door resisted for a moment, then jerked open, its hinges screaming protest. The sound made the hairs on the back of Brian's neck stand up. She drew her sword. Even in mail and boiled leather, she felt naked.
Go on, my lady, urged Nimble Dick behind her. What are you waiting for? Old Crab's been dead 1,000 years.
What was she waiting for? Brain told herself that she was being foolish. The sound was just the sea, echoing endlessly through the caverns beneath the castle, rising and falling with each wave. It did sound like whispering, though, and for a moment she could almost see the heads sitting on their shelves and muttering to one another.
I should have used the sword, one of them was saying. I should have used the magic sword.
Podrick, said Brain, there's a sword and scabbard wrapped up in my bedroll. Bring them here to me.
Yes, sir, my lady, I will.
The boy went running off.
A sword? Nimble Dick scratched behind his ear. You got a sword in your hand. What do you need another for?
This one's for you. Brain offered him the hilt.
For true?
Crab reached out hesitantly as if the blade might bite him. The mistrustful maid's given old Dick a sword.
You do know how to use one. I'm a crab.
He snatched the long sword from her hand. I got the same blood as old Sir Clarence. He slashed the air and grinned at her. It's the sword that makes the lord, some say. When Podrick Payne returned, he held Oathkeeper as gingerly as if it were a child. Nimble Dick gave a whistle at the sight of the ornate scabbard with its row of lion's heads, but grew quiet when she drew the blade and tried a cut. Even the sound of it is sharper than an ordinary sword.
With me, she told Crab.
She slipped sideways through the postern, ducking her head to pass beneath the doorway's arch. The bailey opened up before her, overgrown. To her left was the main gate and the collapsed shell of what might have been a stable. Saplings were poking out of half the stalls and growing up through the dry brown thatch of its roof. To her right, she saw rotted wooden steps descending into the darkness of a dungeon or a root cellar. Where the keep had been was a pile of collapsed stones, overgrown with green and purple moss. The yard was all weeds and pine needles. Soldier pines were everywhere, drawn up in solemn ranks. In their midst was a pale stranger, a slender young weirwood with a trunk as white as a cloistered maid. Dark red leaves sprouted from its reaching branches. Beyond was the emptiness of sky and sea where the wall had collapsed, and the remnants of a fire. The whispers nibbled at her ears, insistent. Brain knelt beside the fire. She picked up a blackened stick, sniffed at it, stirred the ashes. Someone was trying to keep warm last night, or else they were trying to send a signal to a passing ship.
Hello! Called Nimble Dick. Anyone here?
Be quiet, Brain told him. Someone might be hiding, wanting to get a look at us before they show themselves. He walked to where the steps went down beneath the ground and peered down into the darkness.
Hello!
He called again. Anyone down there?
Brian saw a sapling sway. From the bushes slid a man so caked with dirt that he looked as if he had sprouted from the earth. A broken sword was in his hand, but it was his face that gave her pause, the small eyes and wide, flat nostrils. She knew that nose. She knew those eyes. Pig, his friends had called him. Everything seemed to happen in a heartbeat. A second man slipped over the lip of the well, making no more noise than a snake might make, slithering across a pile of wet leaves. He wore an iron half-helm wrapped in stained red silk, and had a short, thick throwing spear in hand. Brian knew him too. From behind her came a rustling, as a head poked down through the red leaves. Crab was standing underneath the weirwood. He looked up and saw the face.
"Here!" he called to Brian. "It's your fool!"
"Dick!" she called urgently.
"To me!"
Shagwell dropped from the weirwood, braying laughter. He was garbed in motley, but so faded and stained that it showed more brown than grey or pink. In place of a jester's flail, he had a triple morning star, three spiked balls chained to a wooden haft. He swung it hard and low, and one of Crab's knees exploded in a spray of blood and bone.
"That's funny!"
Shagwell crowed as Dick fell. The sword she'd given him went flying from his hand and vanished in the weeds. He writhed on the ground, screaming and clutching at the ruins of his knee.
"Oh, look!" said Shagwell. "It's Smuggler Dick! The one who made the map for us. Did you come all this way to give us back our gold?"
"Please," Dick whimpered. "Please don't, my leg. Does it hurt? I can make it stop."
"Leave him be," said Brain.
"Don't,"
shrieked Dick, lifting bloody hands to shield his head. Shagwell whirled the spiked ball once around his head and brought it down in the middle of Crab's face. There was a sickening crunch. In the silence that followed, Brain could hear the sound of her own heart.
"Bad shags,"
said the man who'd come creeping from the well. When he saw Brain's face, he laughed.
"You again, woman? What, come to hunt us down? Or did you miss our friendly faces?"
Shagwell danced from foot to foot and spun his flail.
"It's me she come for. She dreams of me every night when she sticks her fingers up her slit. She wants me, lads, the big horse, Mr. Merry Shags. I'm going to fuck her up the arse and pump her full of motley seed until she whelps a little me."
"You need to use a different hole for that, Shags,"
said Timian in his Dornish drawl.
"I'd best use all her holes, then, just to make certain."
He moved to her right as Pig was circling around to her left, forcing her back toward the ragged edge of the cliff.
"Passage for three,"
Brain remembered. "There are only three of you." Timian shrugged.
"We all went our own ways after we left Harrenhal. Urswick and his lot rode south for Old Town. Rorge thought he might slip out at Salt Pans. Me and my lads made for Maidenpool, but we couldn't get near a ship."
The Dornishman hefted his spear.
"You did for Vargo with that bite, you know. His ear turned black and started leaking pus. Rorge and Urswick were for leaving, but the goat says we got to hold his castle. Lord of Harrenhal, he says he is. No one was going to take it off him. He said it's slobbery, the way he always talked. We heard that Mountain killed him piece by piece, a hand one day, a foot the next, lopped off neat and clean. They bandaged up the stump so Hote didn't die. He was saving his cock for last, but some bird called him to King's Landing, so he finished it and rode off. I am not here for you. I am looking for my—" she almost said, "my sister."
"For a fool."
"I'm a fool,"
Shagwell announced happily. "The wrong fool," blurted Brain. "The one I want is with a high-born girl, the daughter of Lord Stark of Winterfell."
"Then it's the hound you want," said Timian. "He's not here neither, as it happens. Just us."
"Sandor Clegane," said Brain. "What do you mean?"
"He's the one that got the Stark girl. The way I hear it, she was making for River Run and he stole her, damned dog."
River Run, thought Brain. She was making for River Run, for her uncle's. How do you know?
"Had it from one of Beric's bunch. The Lightning Lord is looking for her too. He sent his men all up and down the Trident, sniffing after her.
We chanced on three of them after Harrenhal and winkled a tale from one before he died. He might have lied. He might have, but he didn't. Later on, we heard how the hound slew three of his brother's men at an inn by the crossroads. A girl was with him there. The innkeep swore to it before Rorge killed him, and the whores said the same. An ugly bunch they were. Not so ugly as you, mind you, but still.
He is trying to distract me, Brain realized, to lull me with his voice. Pig was edging closer. Shagwell took a hop toward her. She backed away from them. They will back me off the cliff if I let them.
Stay away, she warned them. I think I'm going to fuck you up the nose, wench, Shagwell announced. Won't that be amusing?
He has a very small cock, Timian explained. Drop that pretty sword, and might be we'll go gentle on you, woman. We need gold to pay these smugglers, that's all. And if I give you gold, you'll let us go.
We will,
Timian smiled. Once you've fucked the lot of us, we'll pay you like a proper whore, a silver for each fuck, or else we'll take the gold and rape you anyway, and do you like the mountain did Lord Vargo. What's your choice?
This!
Brain threw herself toward Pig. He jerked his broken blade up to protect his face, but as he went high, she went low. Oathkeeper bit through leather, wool, skin, and muscle into the sellsword's thigh. Pig cut back wildly as his leg went out from under him. His broken sword scraped against her chainmail before he landed on his back. Brain stabbed him through the throat, gave the blade a hard turn, and slid it out, whirling, just as Timian's spear came flashing past her face. I did not flinch, she thought, as blood ran red down her cheek. Did you see, Sir Goodwin? She hardly felt the cut.
Your turn,
she told Timian, as the Dornishman pulled out a second spear, shorter and thicker than the first.
Throw it!
So you can dance away and charge me. I'd end up dead as pig.
No, get her, Shags.
You get her,
Shagwell said.
Did you see what she did to Pig? She's mad with moon blood.
The fool was behind her, Timian in front. No matter how she turned, one was at her back.
Get her, urged Timian, and you can fuck her corpse.
Oh, you do love me. The morning star was whirling. Choose one, Brain told herself. Choose one and kill him quickly. Then a stone came out of nowhere and hit Shagwell in the head. Brain did not hesitate. She flew at Timian. He was better than Pig, but he had only a short throwing spear, and she had a Valyrian steel blade. Oathkeeper was alive in her hands. She had never been so quick. The blade became a grey blur. He wounded her in the shoulder as she came at him, but she slashed off his ear and half his cheek, hacked the head off his spear, and put a foot of rippled steel into his belly through the links of chainmail burnie he was wearing. Timian was still trying to fight as she pulled her blade from him, its fullers running red with blood. He clawed at his belt and came up with a dagger, so Brain cut his hand off. That one was for Jamie.
Mother have mercy,
the Dornishman gasped, the blood bubbling from his mouth and spurting from his wrist.
Finish it. Send me back to Dorn, you bloody bitch.
She did. Shagwell was on his knees when she turned, looking dazed as he fumbled for the morning star. As he staggered to his feet, another stone slammed him in the ear. Podrick had climbed the fallen wall and was standing amongst the ivy, glowering, a fresh rock in his hand.
I told you I could fight, he shouted down.
Shagwell tried to crawl away.
I yield,
the fool cried.
I yield. You mustn't hurt, sweet Shagwell. I'm too droll to die.
You are no better than the rest of them. You have robbed and raped and murdered.
Oh, I have. I have. I shan't deny it. But I'm amusing with all my japes and capers. I make men laugh.
And women weep.
Is that my fault? Women have no sense of humour.
Brain lowered Oathkeeper. Dig a grave. There, beneath the weirwood. She pointed with her blade.
I have no spade.
You have two hands. One more than you left Jamie.
Why bother? Leave them for the crows.
Timian and Pig can feed the crows. Nimble Dick will have a grave. He was a crab. This is his place. The ground was soft from rain, but even so it took the fool the rest of the day to dig down deep enough. Night was falling by the time he was done, and his hands were bloody and blistered. Brain sheathed Oathkeeper, gathered up Dick Crab, and carried him to the hole. His face was hard to look on. I'm sorry that I never trusted you.
I don't know how to do that any more. As she knelt to lay the body down, she thought, the fool will make his try now whilst my back is turned. She heard his ragged breathing, half a heartbeat, before Podrick cried out his warning. Shagwell had a jagged chunk of rock clutched in one hand. Brain had her dagger up her sleeve. A dagger will beat a rock almost every time. She knocked aside his arm and punched the steel into his bowels. Laugh, she snarled at him. He moaned instead. Laugh, she repeated, grabbing his throat with one hand and stabbing at his belly with the other. Laugh, she kept saying it over and over until her hand was red up to the wrist and the stink of the fool's dying was like to choke her. But Shagwell never laughed. The sobs that Brain heard were all her own. When she realized that, she threw down her knife and shuddered. Podrick helped her lower Nimble Dick into his hole. By the time they were done, the moon was rising. Brain rubbed the dirt from her hands and tossed two dragons down into the grave.
"Why did you do that, my lady, sir?" asked Pod.
"It was the reward I promised him for finding me the fool." Laughter sounded from behind them. She ripped Oathkeeper from her sheath and whirled, expecting more bloody mummers. But it was only Heil Hunt, atop the crumbling wall, his legs crossed. "If there are brothels down in hell, the wretch will thank you," the knight called down. "Elsewise, that's a waste of good gold. I keep my promises. What are you doing here?" "Lord Randall bid me follow you. If by some freak's chance you stumbled onto Sansa Stark, he told me to bring her back to Maidenpool. Have no fear. I was commanded not to harm you." Brain snorted, "as if you could. What will you do now, my lady?"
"Cover him.
About the girl, I meant. The Lady Sansa." Brain thought a moment. She was making for River Run, if Timian told it true. Somewhere along the way she was taken by the Hound. "If I find him, he'll kill you, or I'll kill him," she said stubbornly. "Will you help me cover up poor Crab, sir?" No true knight could refuse such beauty. Sir Heil climbed down from the wall. Together they shoved the dirt on top of Nimble Dick as the moon rose higher in the sky, and down below the ground the heads of forgotten kings whispered secrets.
Catelyn. They carried the corpses in upon their shoulders and laid them beneath the dais. A silence fell across the torch-lit hall, and in the quiet Catelyn could hear Grey Wind howling half a castle away. "He smells the blood," she thought. "Through stone walls and wooden doors, through night and rain, he still knows the scent of death and ruin." She stood at Rob's left hand beside the high seat, and for a moment felt almost as if she were looking down at her own dead, at Bran and Rickon. These boys had been much older, but death had shrunken them. Naked and wet, they seemed such little things, so still it was hard to remember them living. The blond boy had been trying to grow a beard. Pale yellow peach fuzz covered his cheeks and jaw above the red ruin the knife had made of his throat. His long golden hair was still wet, as if he had been pulled from a bath. By the look of him, he had died peacefully, perhaps in sleep. But his brown-haired cousin had fought for life. His arms bore slashes where he'd tried to block the blades, and red still trickled slowly from the stab wounds that covered his chest and belly and back, like so many tongueless mouths, though the rain had washed him almost clean. Rob had donned his crown before coming to the hall, and the bronze shone darkly in the torchlight. Shadows hid his eyes as he looked upon the dead. Does he see Bran and Rickon as well? She might have wept, but there were no tears left in her. The dead boys were pale from long imprisonment, and both had been fair. Against their smooth white skin, the blood was shockingly red, unbearable to look upon. Will they lay Sansa down naked, beneath the Iron Throne, after they've killed her? Will her skin seem as white, her blood as red? From outside came the steady wash of rain and the restless howling of a wolf. Her brother Edmure stood to Rob's right, one hand upon the back of his father's seat, his face still puffy from sleep. They had woken him, as they had her, pounding on his door in the black of night to yank him rudely from his dreams. Were they good dreams, brother? Do you dream of sunlight and laughter and a maiden's kisses? I pray you do. Her own dreams were dark and laced with terrors. Rob's captains and lords' bannermen stood about the hall, some mailed and armed, others in various states of dishevelment and undress. Sir Reynold and his uncle Sir Rolf were among them, but Rob had seen fit to spare his queen this ugliness. "The crag is not far from Castle Rock," Catelyn recalled. "Jane may well have played with these boys when all of them were children." She looked down again upon the corpses of the squires, Tion Frey and Willem Lannister, and waited for her son to speak. It seemed a very long time before Rob lifted his eyes from the bloody dead. "Small John," he said, "tell your father to bring them in." Wordless, Small John Umber turned to obey, his steps echoing in the great stone hall. As the great John marched his prisoners through the doors, Catelyn made note of how some other men stepped back to give them room, as if treason could somehow be passed by a touch, a glance, a cough. The captors and the captives looked very much alike, big men every one, with thick beards and long hair. Two of the great John's men were wounded, and three of their prisoners. Only the fact that some had spears and others empty scabbards served to set them apart. All were clad in mail hauberks or shirts of sewn rings, with heavy boots and thick cloaks, some of wool and some of fur. "The North is hard and cold and has no mercy," Ned had told her when she first came to Winterfell 1,000 years ago. "Five," said Rob when the prisoner stood before him, wet and silent. "Is that all of them?"
"There were eight," rumbled the great John. "We killed two taking them, and a third is dying now."
Rob studied the faces of the captives. "It required eight of you to kill two unarmed squires?" Edmure Tully spoke up.
"They murdered two of my men as well to get into the tower, Delp and Elwood."
"It was no murder, sir,"
said Lord Rickard Carstock, no more discomforted by the ropes about his wrist than by the blood that trickled down his face.
"Any man who steps between a father and his vengeance asks for death."
His words rang against Catelyn's ears, harsh and cruel as the pounding of a war drum. Her throat was dry as bone. "I did this. These two boys died so my daughters might live." "I saw your sons die that night in the Whispering Wood," Rob told Lord Carstark. "Tion Frey did not kill Torrhen. Willem Lannister did not slay Eddard. How then can you call this vengeance? This was folly and bloody murder. Your sons died honourably on a battlefield with swords in their hands."
"They died," said Rickard Carstark, yielding no inch of ground. "The Kingslayer cut them down. These two were of his ilk. Only blood can pay for blood."
"The blood of children?" Rob pointed at the corpses. "How old were they? 12, 13? "Squires."
"Squires die in every battle."
"Die fighting, yes. Tion Frey and Willem Lannister gave up their swords in the Whispering Wood. They were captives locked in a cell, asleep, unarmed. Boys. Look at them." Lord Carstark looked instead at Catelyn.
"Tell your mother to look at them," he said. "She slew them as much as I."
Catelyn put a hand on the back of Rob's seat. The hall seemed to spin about her. She felt as if she might retch. "My mother had naught to do with this," Rob said angrily. "This was your work, your murder, your treason."
How can it be treason to kill Lannisters when it is not treason to free them? Asked Carstark harshly. Has your grace forgotten that we are at war with Castle Rock? In war, you kill your enemies. Didn't your father teach you that, boy?
Boy!
The Great John dealt Richard Carstark a buffet with a mail fist that sent the other lord to his knees. Leave him! Rob's voice rang with command. Umber stepped back away from the captive. Lord Carstark spit out a broken tooth.
Yes, Lord Umber, leave me to the king. He means to give me a scolding before he forgives me. That's how he deals with treason, our king in the north.
He smiled a wet red smile.
Or should I call you the king who lost the north, your grace?
The Great John snatched a spear from the man beside him and jerked it to his shoulder.
Let me spit him, sire. Let me open his belly so we can see the colour of his guts.
The doors of the hall crashed open, and the Blackfish entered with water running from his cloak and helm. Tully, men-at-arms, followed him in, whilst outside lightning cracked across the sky and a hard black rain pounded against the stones of River Run. Sir Brendan removed his helm and went to one knee.
Your grace, was all he said, but the grimness of his tone spoke volumes.
I will hear Sir Brendan privily in the audience chamber. Rob rose to his feet. Great John, keep Lord Carstark here till I return, and hang the other seven. The Great John lowered his spear.
Even the dead ones?
Yes, I will not have such fouling my lord uncle's rivers. Let them feed the crows. One of the captives dropped to his knees.
Mercy, sire, I killed no one. I only stood at the door to watch for guards.
Rob considered that for a moment. Did you know what Lord Rickard intended? Did you see the knives drawn? Did you hear the shouts, the screams, the cries for mercy?
I did, but I took no part. I was only the watcher, I swear it.
Lord Umber, said Rob, this one was only the watcher. Hang him last, so he may watch the others die. Mother, uncle, with me, if you please.
He turned away as the Great John's men closed upon the prisoners and drove them from the hall at spear point. Outside the thunder crashed and boomed, so loud it sounded as if the castle were coming down about their ears.
Is this the sound of a kingdom falling? Catelyn wondered. It was dark within the audience chamber, but at least the sound of the thunder was muffled by another thickness of wall. A servant entered with an oil lamp to light the fire, but Rob sent him away and kept the lamp. There were tables and chairs, but only Edmure sat, and he rose again when he realized that the others had remained standing. Rob took off his crown and placed it on the table before him. The Blackfish shut the door.
The Carstarks are gone. All?
Was it anger or despair that thickened Rob's voice like that? Even Catelyn was not certain. All the fighting men, Sir Brendan replied. A few camp followers and serving men were left with their wounded. We questioned as many as we needed to be certain of the truth. They started leaving at nightfall, stealing off in ones and twos at first, and then in larger groups. The wounded men and servants were told to keep the campfires lit so no one would know they'd gone, but once the rains began, it didn't matter.
Will they reform away from River Run? Asked Rob.
No, they've scattered, hunting. Lord Carstark has sworn to give the hand of his maiden daughter to any man high-born or low who brings him the head of the Kingslayer.
Gods be good. Catelyn felt ill again. Near 300 riders and twice as many mounts melted away in the night. Rob rubbed his temples where the crown had left its mark in the soft skin above his ears. All the mounted strength of Carhold lost.
Lost by me. By me, may the gods forgive me.
Catelyn did not need to be a soldier to grasp the trap Rob was in. For the moment he held the Riverlands, but his kingdom was surrounded by enemies to every side but east, where Lysa sat, aloof on her mountaintop.
Even the trident was scarce secure, so long as the Lord of the Crossing withheld his allegiance. And now, to lose the Karstarks as well. "No word of this must leave River Run," her brother Edmure said. "Lord Tywin would, the Lannisters pay their debts. They are always saying that. Mother have mercy when he hears."
"Sansa."
Catelyn's nails dug into the soft flesh of her palms, so hard did she close her hand. Rob gave Edmure a look that chilled. "Would you make me a liar, as well as a murderer, uncle?"
"We need speak no falsehood. Only say nothing. Bury the boys, and hold our tongues till the war's done. Willem was son to Sir Kevin Lannister, and Lord Tywin's nephew. Tien was Lady Jenna's and a Frey. We must keep the news from the twins as well, until we can bring the murdered dead back to life," said Brynden Blackfish sharply. "The truth escaped with the Karstarks, Edmure. It's too late for such games."
"I owe their fathers truth," said Rob. "And justice. I owe them that as well." He gazed at his crown, the dark gleam of bronze, the circle of iron swords. "Lord Rickard defied me, betrayed me. I have no choice but to condemn him. Gods know what the Karstark foot will do with Roose Bolton when they hear I've executed their liege for a traitor. Bolton must be warned."
"Lord Karstark's heir was at Harrenhal as well," Sir Brynden reminded him. "The elder son, the one the Lannisters took captive on the Green Fork. Harrion. His name is Harrion."
Rob laughed bitterly. "A king had best know the names of his enemies, don't you think?" The Blackfish looked at him shrewdly.
"You know that for a certainty, that this will make young Karstark your enemy?"
"What else would he be? I'm about to kill his father. He's not like to thank me."
"He might. There are sons who hate their fathers, and in a stroke you will make him Lord of Carhold."
Rob shook his head. "Even if Harrion were that sort, he could never openly forgive his father's killer. His own men would turn on him. These are Northmen, uncle. The North remembers."
"Pardon him, then," urged Edmure Tully.
Rob stared at him in frank disbelief. Under that gaze, Edmure's face reddened.
"Spare his life, I mean. I don't like the taste of it any more than you, sire. He slew my men as well. Poor Delp had only just recovered from the wound Sir Jamie gave him. Karstark must be punished, certainly. Keep him in chains, I say."
"A hostage?" said Catelyn. "It might be best."
"Yes, a hostage." Her brother seized on her musing as agreement. "Tell the son that so long as he remains loyal, his father will not be harmed. Otherwise, we have no hope of the Freys now, not if I offer to marry all Lord Walder's daughters and carry his litter besides. If we should lose the Karstarks as well, what hope is there?"
"What hope?" Rob let out a breath, pushed his hair back from his eyes, and said, "We've had naught from Sir Roderick in the north. No response from Walder Frey to our new offer. Only silence from the Eyrie." He appealed to his mother. "Will your sister never answer us? How many times must I write her? I will not believe that none of the birds have reached her." Her son wanted comfort, Catelyn realized. He wanted to hear that it would be all right. But her king needed truth. "The birds have reached her, though she may tell you they did not. If it ever comes to that, expect no help from that quarter, Rob. Lysa was never brave. When we were girls together, she would run and hide whenever she'd done something wrong. Perhaps she thought our Lord Father would forget to be wroth with her if he could not find her. It is no different now. She ran from King's Landing for fear, to the safest place she knows, and she sits on her mountain hoping everyone will forget her. The Knights of the Vale could make all the difference in this war," said Rob. "But if she will not fight, so be it. I've asked only that she open the Bloody Gate for us, and provide ships at Gulltown to take us north. The high road would be hard, but not so hard as fighting our way up the Neck. If I could land at White Harbour,
I could flank Moat Cailin and drive the Iron Men from the north in half a year.
It will not happen, sire, said the Blackfish. Cat is right. Lady Lyser is too fearful to admit an army to the Vale, any army. The bloody gate will remain closed.
The others can take her, then, Rob cursed in a fury of despair. Bloody Rickard Carstark as well, and Theon Greyjoy, Walder Frey, Tywin Lannister, and all the rest of them. Gods be good, why would any man ever want to be a king? When everyone was shouting, King in the North, King in the North, I told myself, swore to myself, that I would be a good king, as honourable as father, strong, just, loyal to my friends, and brave when I face my enemies. Now I can't even tell one from the other. How did it all get so confused? Lord Rickard's fought at my side in half a dozen battles. His sons died for me in the Whispering Wood. Theon Frey and Willem Lannister were my enemies, yet now I have to kill my dead friend's father for their sakes. He looked at them all. Will the Lannisters thank me for Lord Rickard's head? Will the Freys?
No,
said Brynden Blackfish, blunt as ever. All the more reason to spare Lord Rickard's life and keep him hostage, Edmure urged. Rob reached down with both hands, lifted the heavy bronze and iron crown, and set it back atop his head. And suddenly, he was a king again. Lord Rickard dies.
But why? Said Edmure. You said yourself.
I know what I said, uncle. It does not change what I must do. The swords in his crown stood stark and black against his brow. In battle, I might have slain Tion and Willem myself, but this was no battle. They were asleep in their beds, naked and unarmed, in a cell where I put them. Rickard Carstark killed more than a Frey and a Lannister. He killed my honour. I shall deal with him at dawn. When day broke, grey and chilly, the storm had diminished to a steady, soaking rain, yet even so the God's Wood was crowded. River lords and northmen, high-born and low, knights and sellswords and stable-boys, they stood amongst the trees to see the end of the night's dark dance. Edmure had given commands, and a headsman's block had been set up before the heart tree. Rain and leaves fell all around them as the Great John's men led Lord Rickard Carstark through the press, hands still bound. His men already hung from River Run's high walls, slumping at the end of long ropes as the rain washed down their darkening faces. Long Lu waited beside the block, but Rob took the poleaxe from his hand and ordered him to step aside. "This is my work," he said. "He dies at my word. He must die by my hand." Lord Rickard Carstark dipped his head stiffly.
"For that much, I thank you, but for naught else."
He had dressed for death in a long black wool surcoat emblazoned with the white sunburst of his house.
"The blood of the first men flows in my veins as much as yours, boy. You would do well to remember that I was named for your grandfather. I raised my banners against King Ares for your father, and against King Joffrey for you. At Oxcross and the Whispering Wood, and in the Battle of the Camps, I rode beside you, and I stood with Lord Eddard on the Trident. We are kin, Stark and Carstark."
"This kinship did not stop you from betraying me," Rob said, "and it will not save you now. Kneel, my lord." Lord Rickard had spoken truly, Catelyn knew. The Carstarks traced their descent to Carlan Stark, a younger son of Winterfell who had put down a rebel lord 1,000 years ago and had been granted lands for his valour. The castle he built had been named Carl's Hold, but that soon became Carhold, and over the centuries the Carhold Starks had become Carstarks.
"Old gods or new, it makes no matter," Lord Rickard told her son. "No man is so accursed as the kinslayer."
"Kneel, traitor," Rob said again, "or must have them force your head onto the block." Lord Carstark knelt.
"The gods shall judge you,"
as you have judged me." He laid his head upon the block. "Rickard Karstark, Lord of Carhold." Rob lifted the heavy axe with both hands. "Here in the sight of gods and men, I judge you guilty of murder and high treason. In mine own name I condemn you. With mine own hand I take your life. Would you speak a final word?" "Kill me, and be cursed!"